call the case.
Case number SCWC 29937, State v. Keokuhaku, arguing for the petitioner Cynthia Kagiwara, arguing for the respondent James Anderson, argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Are you both ready to proceed today?
We are. Yes, Your
Honor. Ms. Kagiwara, you've asked for to reserve 10 minutes in rebuttal, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And Mr. Anderson will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go on your argument, correct? Okay, great. If you would, please proceed.
Okay. Good morning. As the panel has directed us to concentrate on the issues concerning the extended term jury trial that happened in this case, I just wanted to point out from the beginning that this was one of the first cases to go to an extended term jury trial before the circuit court. And as such, there were really only two issues that the jury had to decide. The first one was whether or not Mr. Keokuhaku had two or more felonies since he had turned 18. And the second was whether or not an extended term was necessary for the protection of the public. And as such, I think that needs to be kept in mind as we're talking about these issues, because I believe what happened in the circuit court was sometimes that focus got lost. Turning first to some of the problems with some of the witnesses that the prosecutor brought in, in particular, there were problems with two witnesses, Mr. Keokuhaku's wife at the time, Kawalani Keokuhaku, and another witness, Gregory Balga. The prosecutor started first by concentrating on Kawi. I'll refer to her as Kawi so there won't be any confusion with Mr. Keokuhaku. And essentially, there were three issues that were somewhat problematic. The first issue that the prosecutor tried to ask Kawi about was something that occurred on April 3rd, 1996. And the problem occurred when Kawi could not remember exactly what had happened. And so then the prosecutor tried to use a writing, a statement that she had given to the police to refresh her memory. Now, it is true that the defense counsel never objected to any problem with this particular incident, but given what happened later, I don't believe we can be confident that there weren't problems here as well. For one thing, the record does not reflect that the prosecutor ever retrieved the statement from the witness after it was used to refresh her memory. And in addition, there were references made to the writing throughout the examination. For example, Kawi herself said, on the paper, it said that he slapped me, which seemed to indicate that she may still be referring to the paper. And then the prosecutor herself referred to the statement numerous times. She said at one point, and you wrote this statement when the incident occurred. And then she said, he also says you're going to die, right? So she is bringing in the statement herself, the prosecutor that is. And then she also said, do you remember in the writing saying, I started getting more scared? So even though there was no objection from the defense, given what happened later, I don't believe we can have confidence that Howie wasn't referring to a writing at that time. Moving on to the more problematic part, the next incident that the prosecutor tried to ask Howie about occurred on July 13, 1996. And after Kawi had used a writing to refresh her memory and testified at length. Later, it turned out that she was indeed reading from the paper. In fact, the defense counsel noticed that she seemed to be reading and asked for a bench conference. And at that point, the court said, you know, prosecutor, please find out whether or not she's reading. And indeed, the prosecutor went back and Kawi said, yes, I'm reading from the paper. And she also indicated that the papers were given to her when she was outside. And so at that point, her testimony was improper. All the testimony that she had supposedly been testifying from her refreshed memory was improper because she was reading from the paper.
Was there a motion to strike?
There was not a motion. I don't believe there was a motion to strike, but there was definitely an objection to that testimony. But instead, what happened is the court allowed the prosecutor instead to then try to bring it in as past recollection recorded. And our position is that that's improper, that once it already came in improperly, being read by the witness, the prosecutor could not then go back and try to bring it in as past recollection recorded.
But if it was properly admitted as past recollection recorded, what would be the harm?
Well, because she had already read from the statement at length.
Do you dispute that the statement was, or do you suggest the statement wasn't properly admitted as past recollection recorded? I mean, she said she'd written it, I think it was the day after the incident at the police station. She remembered it, identified her signature.
Right.
All the foundation was there.
Right.
Correct?
Although she did indicate, you know, some problems with, she was brought there by her mother and her mother made her sign it and everything. But yes, she did admit that she wrote it, she signed it the next day.
So if the foundation was there to get it in as past recollection recorded, what would be the harm in her having testified to the same thing?
Well, the harm was, you know, that she actually read from the statement. So, you know, she...
Did she say something different from what was in the statement? If the statement comes in, what's the harm in her saying it verbally and then doing it again?
Well,
to
be clear, too, only part of the statement was brought in. And the part of the statement was that was brought in was essentially the part that she had trouble remembering. But, you know...
What exhibit was that?
Pardon?
What exhibit was that?
It was exhibit... Hold on just a minute. I'm sorry, there were several exhibits here. I believe it was 14, but let me just double check. I believe it was exhibit 14, but I'll just double check that and let you know on rebuttal. You know, but there is support that, you know, the testimony should have been stricken rather than just allowed to remain on the record. And then it was almost bolstered again by having then the statement read by the prosecutor. You know, and the point I wanted to make, too, was the Intermediate Court of Appeals didn't really address the fact that it first came in as improper or present recollection refreshed, only jumped to the fact that there was, as Justice Reckmull has pointed out, there's proper past recollection recorded. But my point is, once it's already come in, you can't unring the bell and then try to do it again until you get it right. And then moving on to the last problematic testimony from Ms. From Cowie was a statement concerning an incident that occurred on October 20th, 1994. And the ICA agreed that that was, both the state and the ICA agreed that that was problematic because she did indeed read from the testimony. And then the prosecutor didn't even try to get it in as past recollection recorded. But the problem there again is some very harmful evidence did come in before they determined that she was reading from the statement. She actually said that Mr. Keohokapu grabbed her, hit her head against the wall, that he bit her, and that he pulled her stomach. And again, that testimony was allowed to remain on the record and go to the jury.
How did that get in?
How did that get in? Because she was reading from the paper.
Well, was it in the context of refreshing recollection?
I believe so, yes. It was during that particular testimony about the October 20th, 1994 incident that the defense counsel noticed that she seemed to be reading from a paper, and that's when he asked, you know, at a bench conference, you know, to find out whether or not she was reading from the paper. The prosecutor went back and indeed clarified that she was, she said, yes, I am reading from the paper.
Did the ICA said that was error, or?
Let's see, I'm trying to remember what the ICA said about that one. Yes, I believe so, because the ICA went on to analyze whether or not it was harmless error, along with the statement from Mr. Balga.
And why wouldn't it be harmless viewed in the context of all the other evidence that came in?
Do you want me to address Mr. Balga's statement first, or do you want me to...
Well, I guess just if you could wrap this one up and address the harmlessness issue.
Okay, just because it also applies to Mr. Balga's statement.
Whatever's easier for you.
But anyways, to answer your question, it's not a question of whether or not there was ample evidence alone. The question is whether or not, once there's improper evidence, whether there's a reasonable possibility that might have contributed to the verdict. I think that's the problem we have here is I think the ICA focused on the sufficiency of the evidence type of issue. But both the ICA in the Ballard case and this court in Machado have said, no, once there's improper evidence admitted, you have to look at how that might have affected the jury's verdict, not just whether there was enough other evidence. And I think that's the problem here, is there is a real possibility that that harmful evidence contributed to the jury's decision.
If I might interrupt you, counsel.
Okay.
Would that other evidence include the criminal history record, which went in without objection, as I understand it, that showing 20 convictions and 4 felony convictions?
Yes.
Is that including burglary 1, robbery 2, promoting a dangerous drug 3, and unlawful use of drug paraphernalia? How that was what the jury had to look at in the big picture of things. Is that correct?
That's, I'm not disputing that there was other evidence, but the problem is here is we're dealing with what is necessary for the protection of the public. And I don't think you can say it's just like a sufficiency of the evidence. I mean, in other jurisdictions, like where there's capital cases, courts have considered, you know, if there's one wrong aggravating factor that comes in, there's mitigating factors, then maybe the jury wouldn't have found it was necessary for the protection of the public. I think the problem, too, is we don't have a definition of what that is, necessary for the protection of the public.
That particular report was Exhibit 11, is that correct?
The October 20th?
Yes.
Yes.
And the state withdrew that exhibit, didn't it?
Yes, but only after she had testified by reading from some of that exhibit, to the points that I had noted. You know, the harmful testimony already came in. So that was before the jury, and they did consider it. So if I may, I want to address Mr. Balga's evidence as well. I don't think there's any disagreement that was improperly admitted as past recollection recorded. That's what the ICA found. Mr. Balga admitted he was a heavy drinker at the time of the incident, and he had no memory whatsoever. And so the ICA found that was not proper foundation for past recollection recorded. So we're left at least with two incidents that came in before the jury that shouldn't, and I would argue that there are some problems with the July one as well, if not the earlier one in April. And as I've pointed out, it's not just a sufficiency of the evidence test, it is whether or not these improper pieces of evidence affected the jury. Are there any further questions on that issue? If not, I'd like to turn to the issue on the jury instructions.
Please do.
Again, you know, I think it's important to focus on the jury was only being asked to determine two narrow questions, and there really wasn't much of an issue on whether or not Mr. Keohokapu had 2 or more prior felonies. That was indeed supported by the record. So
what's wrong with the instructions?
What's wrong with the instructions? They're irrelevant, for one thing. The court told the jury about not only the Hawaii paroling authority, but that they would be setting a mandatory minimum sentence, and then at length described their procedures. That was completely irrelevant to what the jury needed to decide. The jury needed to decide whether this was necessary for the protection of the public.
So I understand, the instructions that you're challenging are instructions 2 and 4. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So the other instructions, you're not objecting to?
No. Just the ones regarding the Hawaii paroling authority.
Which were, and again, 2 talks about the means by which the paroling authority sets a minimum term, or the fact that it sets a minimum term.
Yes. And then I believe 4 goes into
parole shall not be granted unless
the description of parole and that kind of thing.
Okay, so the other instructions that talks about what an indeterminate term of imprisonment is, and the instruction that talks about what parole is, those were okay in your view. They were at least acceptable background information.
They were acceptable, yes.
Isn't that inconsistent with your position?
What is that?
Allowing in instruction number 7 on indeterminate term of imprisonment.
Well, these were the only instructions that were objected to, was the 2 and 4.
Right. But shouldn't you be objecting to that, too?
If you say so, Your Honor.
An indeterminate term of imprisonment is defined as something to be determined by the Hawaii Paroling Authority, or ultimately is determined, the sentence is ultimately determined by the Hawaii Paroling Authority.
Well, I don't think, I'm not sure that the sentence is determined by, but the setting of the minimum term.
Well, this is a reference to the fact that a minimum term would be determined by the Hawaii Paroling Authority.
Yes.
So does that introduce the whole idea of parole and the effect that would have on the sentence?
Yes, I guess it would, Your Honor.
Can I ask you this? Is it your position that the jury, was it, the court here instructed the jury as to what the two options were, 20 years or life with parole, is that correct?
Yes.
Is it your position that it's appropriate for the jury, for the court to instruct the jury what the options are?
Well, I believe that, you know, the court does have to instruct the jury about the extended term, because the life with the possibility of parole, because that's essentially what the jury is deciding, is whether or not it's necessary for the protecting the public to impose the extended term.
So the jury needs to understand what the options are that it's weighing.
Right. But the jury does not need to understand what the function of the Hawaii Paroling Authority is.
But if you say with the possibility of parole, aren't you in fact introducing that component?
You are, but I do not believe that you need to then explain the whole procedure that the Hawaii Paroling Authority will go through and the fact that they're going to send a minimum
term.
When
a judge sentences, you know, the jury's only introduced because of Apprendi, right? They have to make the findings of fact.
Yes.
When the judge used to make that decision, did the judge take into consideration the possibility of parole in determining whether a defendant should be sentenced to an extended term?
Well, no. I would argue that...
Then why should the jury...
The only thing that the jury should decide is whether or not he had two or more felonies.
If the judge didn't, then why should the jury?
I don't think it should be any different.
Then you should have objected to number six.
Okay. Well, I note the error then.
But the statute is life with parole, correct? That's the sentence.
That's the sentence, but...
So if you're telling the jury that's the option, should you tell the jury what parole is, at least in some sense, or leave the jury at sea to figure that out for itself?
But the jury doesn't have to determine what the penalty, you know, how the sentence is going to be executed. The jury's role is just to determine whether or not it's necessary for the protection of the public. They shouldn't be focusing on what's going to happen afterwards,
right,
and whether or not he's going to get out earlier because he's going to get a minimum term set before the Hawaii Paroling Authority.
That's why you objected to two and four,
yes,
correct?
Yes, and that's the problem is it tends to suggest that Mr. Keohokapu might end up with a shorter sentence if he doesn't get the extended term because...
Not only that, doesn't it allow the jury to speculate as to what might happen after the sentence is imposed?
Yes.
And if a judge were to sentence, would the judge be correct in speculating as to what possibility of parole meant, whether the defendant would have a possibility of obtaining parole in determining whether an extended sentence should be imposed?
No, I don't think, I think that it should
then
be the same.
Why is the jury permitted to do that?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't believe the jury should be permitted to do that.
And you should have objected to number six also.
Okay. And perhaps that was my oversight because I was focusing on the instructions that the trial counsel objected to.
But isn't six an indeterminate term of imprisonment? Wasn't that part of the court's instruction seven, which said that he was going to be subject to a maximum indeterminate term of imprisonment of 20 years, right? So the court told the jury this is one sentencing option.
Yes.
And then in an attempt apparently to explain to the jury what an indeterminate term of imprisonment is, which most people would know, it provided a brief definition. What's the error in that?
Well, the error is that's not something that the jury needs to decide or consider. The jury only needs to decide whether this was necessary for the protection of the public. So what happens to Mr. Keohokapu afterwards, how his sentence is actually executed, that's not the province of the jury.
So the jury should just be left to guess at what indeterminate term of imprisonment means?
Well, they don't need to know to the extent what the Hawaii Paroling Authority is going to do afterwards.
Right, but six just provides a definition. An indeterminate term of imprisonment is a sentence to imprisonment for the maximum period defined by law subject to termination at any time after service of the minimum term determined by the Hawaii Paroling Authority. So it's simply a definition of what that word, that phrase means.
Right, but my position is that there's no need to go into this long description of what the Hawaii Paroling Authority is going to do.
Right, which is why you objected to 2 and 4,
yes,
but not 6, which,
yes,
is the one I just read.
Yes, that's correct.
Is that still your position?
Well,
if you use the term indeterminate, that automatically incorporates the procedure followed by the paroling authority, which would involve your objection to 2 and 4.
Well, perhaps the better approach in the future would be to have some different type of instruction.
Well, if you instructed the jury that, and this is the only thing that the judge would consider, the defendant would be sentenced to a maximum of, a maximum term of imprisonment of 20 years, which could be extended to a maximum term of imprisonment for life, wouldn't that be accurate?
That would be accurate, yes, Your Honor.
And that would exclude the references to the possibility of parole, which would allow the jury to speculate whether or not its sentence might allow this person to obtain a lesser sentence because of the possibility of parole.
Yes, Your Honor, that does sound like a good way to address that problem and just avoid the mention of parole altogether. If there are no further questions at this time, I'd like to save my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you. Mr. Anderson?
May it please the Court, James Anderson from the State. I have a little bit different take on the evidentiary portion of this sentencing phase of the trial. The April, July, and October incidents at issue with respect to the refreshed recollection. The April statement was refreshed properly. She understood, she saw it, she understood, she said, yes, I do recall, and she testified accordingly. July, and then Kawi proceeded testifying to the July and October events. During the October testimony, defense counsel noticed that she could have been reading. The prosecutor clarified, were you reading? Yes, I was reading from the paper. Now I understand where you're going at, Justice Okoa, because it was a bit irregular how that July incident was refreshed. The prosecutor then approached and had Kawi read her paper. Does this refresh your recollection? Yes, it does. Was it consistent, with what you testified? Yes, except for the head hair pulling and head butting. So she didn't remember all of it, and she was very candid to that effect. The prosecutor then just decided not to delve into the October event at all. And we concede that, and it should have been stricken, but I think that was an oversight. But anyway, that's that. Now, with respect to the past recollection recorded, I'm not sure that there is a corroboration component in 802.1 sub 4. I think by showing that the writing was made by the person, by the declarant, that the writing was made at the time of the event, then that satisfies the requirement that it was made, that the writing was made when the matter was fresh in the declarant's memory, and that it was accurate. Plus, you have the corroboration, the additional trustworthiness of the cross-examination.
So you're saying that although 802.2.1 subsection 4 says, and to reflect, shown to have made or adopted by the witness when the matter was fresh in the witness's memory, and to reflect that knowledge correctly,
right,
you don't have to have testimony that
it was accurate? I don't see how you can even have that, Your Honor. It doesn't even make sense. Because how can you even say that if you don't remember it in the first place? It's just ridiculous to me. I think both of those statements should have been brought in. And if there's corroboration required with respect to Gregory Valga's report, well, his 252 came from the Berg 1 incident. You can compare State's Exhibit 10, in which all the 20 felonies came in against his statement, which is State's Exhibit 21. Same thing. So if you needed cooperation, we got it. So I think, anyway, even if you find error, there's such a plethora of domestic violence incidents. And I say the April 1 is good, but there's also a couple of ones in 2008 and the TRO violation. They're all the same. It's headbutting, it's kicking, it's biting, it's It was an overflow. It's
what incidents didn't involve Cowie?
What incidents?
Convictions? Well, what Gregory convictions?
Baldus, the Gregory Baldenberg one. I think there was also a Rob 2. There was a PDD 3. You know, when he was on the bed, the police came in, and there's all the drug para too. Yeah, those, yeah. But, yeah. Yeah.
The substantial number of convictions related to his relationship with Cowie.
Yeah, there were, exactly. But there were also those outside, too, Your Honor.
You disagree with the ICA that Balga's past recollection recorded should not have been read to the jury?
Yes.
You agree?
I think it should have come in, yes.
Well, you disagree with
yes,
the ICA?
Yes, I disagree, yes. Because I think he identified the report. He said it was made. It was in his handwriting, date of birth, social security number, everything, all the indicia of trustworthiness. And it was dated at 12:45 a.m., which was about 40 minutes after the incident itself.
He testified he didn't remember it, though.
He didn't remember it. Now, that's why they can't, you know, they either remember it because they don't want to, or they're recanting, or they generally don't remember it. But this is why you need that indicia. Of trustworthiness.
I'm sorry, was that argued to the jury?
You know, I'm not sure.
Okay. The fact that the burglary conviction is reflected in the record doesn't affect what was read to the jury in terms of the actions of the petitioner.
No, I don't think so.
So that would be something over and above simply the conviction reflected in the record. What about October 1994?
October when we conceded it, we just dropped. We let it go. And I agree, you know, it should have been stricken, but the court didn't get around to it. I think there's so much of this evidence coming in at that time. It was just an oversight. But I still think that with all the other DV incidents that take their place of the problematic ones and the other, and States Exhibit 10, which illustrates his 20 prior convictions, I think the exception.
Just curious, but I noticed the all arrests went into the record also. His arrests. The rap sheet showed.
No, that was those were excluded, I think, Your Honor. I think in States Exhibit 10, initially they came there 54 or something like that, but they only. There was redacted just to reflect the felony convictions. I mean, the convictions.
The convictions came in.
Yes.
But the rap sheet included all the arrests
no,
did not go in?
No, it did not come in. So our position is harmless, if error at all. With respect to moving on to the instructions.
Mr. Anderson, can you explain why instructions 2 and 4 were relevant at all?
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that they're at least marginally relevant because they provided a comprehensive procedure of the sentence of what he could receive and how he could be sentenced, how the whole procedure, because parole was involved.
Can you envision a circumstance where too much information creates mischief with the jury?
I think I could. For instance, in those cases cited by the opposing counsel where the jury was explained what the minimum term would be before he's eligible for parole, that would certainly be wrong. But in this case, they weren't told what it was. They were just told that the HPA would. In fact, just last week, the second defendant in the taxicab murder was convicted. In the paper, it said he's subject to life in prison with a possibility of parole. And the Hawaii Paroling Authority will set the minimum term. I think this is pretty common sense. And I think they're not going to set it. Also, the other instructions, unless he has exemplary behavior. I think these are just common sense things. And of course, the caveat here is.
Even if common sense, is that supposed to enter into the consideration of the jury?
Well, I don't know how to answer that, Your Honor, except for the fact that it was just informative. You know, maybe it went overboard.
Informing them of, why inform them if it doesn't enter into their consideration?
And that's why it's marginally relevant.
That's why?
It's marginally relevant. There is some relevance to it because it deals with punishment. That's the whole idea of this sentencing phase. It's punishment, and these are the
The jury doesn't enter the sentence in this case, does it?
No, they just make the eligibility determination, absolutely, under 662.
So what relevance is parole to them, or whether the sentence is an indeterminate sentence, which means it would, the ultimate sentence might be determined by the parole board?
No, I understand your position, and all I can say is, fall back of it is just informative and trying to apprise the jury of the totality of the situation.
Well, Mr. Anderson, do you think that the jury here was instructed that he was subject to a maximum indeterminate term of imprisonment of 20 years, and then the instructions also indicated that the extended term would be life with the possibility of parole. Do you agree with those? Do you think those instructions were appropriate, or do you believe that they should have been, cut short so they would simply say 20 years and life?
Well, that wouldn't be accurate then, because this is statutory. This is all the every point except for instruction number 4 are based upon statute 706669245 subsection 5. But I think instruction number 4 is kind of harmless because it just reiterates 706-6695.
Isn't it more dangerous not to tell the jury? I'm sorry. Go ahead, finish.
No, 4, subsection 4, not 5.
Sorry. Isn't it more dangerous not to tell the jury what the specific term would be? You know, you distinguish the cases from this case because in those cases there was a specific term that the prosecution argued. Here, there's no specific term. All it says is possibility of parole. So the imagination of the jury can run as far as their minds can take them. Because no one tells them that there's a limit or that, the possibility might never occur. And so they're free to just go and speculate about the effect of parole on the sentence to be given the defendant.
But you see, Your Honor, they were told no. Don't speculate. Consider it at
right.
all.
And if they're not to consider it, which presents another issue, right? If they're told don't consider it, don't use it, then why are they told about it?
Just inform them. That's all I can say. You know, but they were told, the bottom line, Your Honor, is they were told, do not consider the effect of parole on your decision.
They had about five, six instructions on parole,
yep.
And then they're told, okay, but don't consider this. What sense does that make?
Well, I don't know about that, but I know, I don't think they're problematic. They're statutory. So they weren't wrong. They were told not to consider it, and there was no communication from the jury suggesting that they even consider it. The parties never argued the aspect of parole at all in closing, and so the presumption that the jury will adhere to that court's instruction, I think, is intact. I don't think they considered it.
Well, was your argument earlier was that parole or the possibility of parole is something that you think is common or sort of understood, it's reported on in the media.
Absolutely.
People have understandings that there's something out there called parole.
Absolutely.
Is that correct?
And I think it's also commonly understood that no one's going to get parole unless you have exemplary behavior. So those things, you know.
So is it your position that the jury should be at least given accurate information and then told don't consider that in your deliberations? Is that the position of the state?
In this case, yes.
What do you mean by that?
I say that since it's done already. No, I don't know about any forward cases, what you folks are going to decide, and what is relevant and what isn't.
Are you suggesting that there was error here, but it was harmless? I'm trying to understand where you're going with that argument.
No, I'm not. I'm saying that it's just purely informative, matter-of-fact instructions, consistent with the parole aspect. That's all. And I'm saying that even if they were erroneous, they're certainly harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. There's no indication that the jury considered it at all.
Well, we don't know what the jury said or did in deliberations, do we?
No, but we have that presumption, Your Honor, that the jury will obey the court's instruction.
Yes, but which instruction? Instruction that tells them? I know one instruction says, this is what happens, it's an indeterminate term, this is what the parole board does, There's a possibility of parole in this case, but don't talk about any of this that I've informed you about. Now, how realistic is that?
Well, I think they're not to consider that. That plainly, that's what that means. That's a caveat to the parole instructions. But
you're aware of all these cases that say you shouldn't be instructing the jury about parole.
You shouldn't be instructing the jury about
or commutation by the governor.
Yes.
Even in cases where the jury sets the sentence of life or death, even in those cases, the courts rule, you shouldn't be talking about parole because it involves a third branch of government. You know, it only leads to speculation about what might occur, which will influence the jury.
You know, I don't know if that's accurate, Your Honor, because I've come across cases, like U.S. Supreme Court cases, that in capital cases, they must be instructed as to parole.
They must be instructed, but they say it doesn't violate the Eighth Amendment if you give an instruction like that, okay. Although there are dissents to that. But,
I'll defer to
you. This court has held, when the parole board grants parole, it has a whole slew of factors, right? Is that correct?
It
weighs those factors.
Right.
So it's not an easy process. It's a process. It's a very complicated process.
Right.
So do you think these instructions convey what goes into the granting of parole?
Probably not, except for the fact that parole will not be granted unless you're.
And you know, this court has said that although this refers to a minimum term, but this court has said the parole board can set the maximum term as the minimum term.
Absolutely.
Or the minimum term as a maximum term.
Absolutely.
In effect, doing away with parole, period.
Yes.
Well, first of all, a lot of the cases that are cited are pre-Apprendi cases. Has there been any change in the law now that the U.S. Supreme Court has directed that juries play a more vigorous role in these kinds of issues?
I do not know. I'm not worried.
So I guess, and the other question I'd have is if our statute says the jury has to decide whether an extended term of imprisonment is necessary for the protection of the public, is that a direction by the legislature that the jury needs to at least be informed of what the actual implications of each sentence are, at least to some extent?
I would think so, yes.
Yeah. If I might interrupt, and at the risk of beating a dead horse, Mr. Anderson, which is against my nature, but don't you think that there's a practical effect here of when the possibility of parole is introduced, the jury inviting the jury to find that an extended term is necessary to protect the public, and then by allowing them thinking, well, somebody else is going to make that determination. Let's make it as long as we can, and then let's see. You know, it's up to other people, the paroling authority, and how the defendant does in prison.
That was a horror that the defense suggests, but I don't think so. Not with our caveat instruction that you're not to consider those aspects of parole. No. I can't say that, no. If there's nothing further.
Okay, thank you very much,
thank
Mr. Anderson. Ms. Kagiwada, your rebuttal.
Thank you. I did confirm that Exhibit 14 was the July 13th, 1996 statement. Exhibit 11 was the October 20th, 1994 statement. In terms of Mr. Balga's statement, there was no indication that his statement was accurate at the time because he has such a huge drinking and drug problem. He couldn't even remember making the statement. He said, yes, that's my writing, yes, that's my signature, but he didn't indicate that there was any, he didn't indicate any memory whatsoever. And I disagree with the state's argument that there couldn't have been corroboration. There could have been corroboration in the terms of injuries, or I believe there is.
How would it deter, excuse me?
I'm sorry?
How would it deter the appropriate function of the jury or the effectiveness of the statute by not telling the jury about the possibility of parole, how would that affect the enforcement of the statute or the function of the jury?
I'm sorry, if you could please repeat the question, I'm not sure I...
Sorry.
Followed. Okay.
Yeah. If you eliminate the reference to the possibility of parole from the instructions...
Yes, okay.
How would that be a detriment to enforcement of the statute or the function of the jury?
I don't believe it would because, again, like I said, the only questions that the jury had to consider was whether or not it was necessary for the protection of the public. So they shouldn't be speculating about parole or what's going to happen once the sentence is imposed.
But doesn't life imply just life in prison imply exactly that, life without parole? Wouldn't that be a reasonable inference for the jury to draw? You're being sentenced for life.
Well, you know, of course, there are those two sentences, life without the possibility
of parole. If the jury were only to be instructed that you have two options, 20 years or life imprisonment, wouldn't it be a reasonable inference for the jury to include that life means exactly that, for the rest of your life? And if so, is that misstating the law and giving the jury an inaccurate impression?
I don't know if the jury would think that way. But I think, you know, the whole issue, though, is by bringing parole in at all, that does cause the jury to speculate that the defendant is not necessarily going to serve whatever sentence they give him.
Well, they the give instruction him in this case says a maximum of 20 years, or I assume that applies also to life. So if you say a maximum of 20 years or extended to a maximum of life, that would not be inaccurate, right? Because
that's
a maximum
correct.
Would just set the outer limit and implies that there may be something less than a maximum.
That's correct. I think the problem is inviting the jury to speculate about there being a shorter sentence at all.
What if the defendant wants the jury to speculate? What if the defendant wants an instruction that says, you know, in my particular circumstances, because of something in my background, I won't be eligible for parole for 25 years. If the jury asked for that, if the defendant asked for that, do you think the defendant should be able to ask for that if the general rule that you're advocating for is parole should be off limits?
I really, you know, that's not this case,
but we have to think about the implications
of
our rules.
I think really the jury should be focusing on whether it's necessary for the protection of the public. They shouldn't be speculating about how the sentence is going to be executed.
So if the defendant asks for that instruction, your position would be shouldn't get the instruction.
I mean, to be fair, yes, because that's the law should be the same. You're focusing on what the jury needs to decide, necessary for the protection of the public. Okay. And that's the only thing that the jury should have decided. I just wanted to correct to something that counsel said about the cases that were cited. At least one case, the Boyle case from Kentucky, does not mention a minimum term. It just the fact that parole at all was mentioned to the jury was problematic. And even the state cannot explain what the relevance of these parole instructions were. The state says that they were informative. But why does the jury even need to hear about them? It invites them to speculate. Yes, I know there was this instruction that they shouldn't consider any action, but after giving all this discussion about the paroling authority, of course the jury's going to consider it. And our point is, why even tell them about it in the first place? I mean, if it's...
What if the argument is, as the prosecution suggests, because they know, they have some understanding from the media, from watching CSI, watching TV, they have some understanding that may or may not be accurate of what parole is, and unless you at least give them something that's factual, they're going to be, and then tell them this is out of play. They're going to be using those, all that information, which may or may not be accurate, that's going to come into their deliberations. Is that a better view? Is that a better approach?
I don't think the trial court
tried to do here?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, we can't help, you know, what the jurors bring from their own personal experience, but again, I think the court should have...
But you can help it if you give them factual information. Well, so this is the law, and you're not to consider this issue, as opposed to just leaving them to bring in all of their preconceptions, whatever they read in the Star Bulletin last week about some other case involving some stabbing, They may have some recollection, some understanding, but it could be completely inaccurate, and they're going to bring that into the room with them.
Well, I would suggest that the court should have directed them that that's not something they should even consider, because they're only deciding whether, based on the evidence, that this was necessary for the protection of the public. So they shouldn't be considering what they learned from the media or what they have in the back of their heads about parole.
It's, so they should be instructed to not give the parole any consideration whatsoever?
They shouldn't, because that's not part of their function in this case. It's directed by statute that they're supposed to consider only these two issues. One other thing I just wanted to point out, in closing argument, the prosecutor did indeed argue about Balga and his injuries and focused a lot on the testimony from Cowie. The April 1996, the July 1996 incident, and then also focused on some other incidents involving Cowie from January and March 2008. However, both of those incidents had some inconsistent testimony from Cowie. It wasn't like she just said, yes, this happened. And then the only other things that came in was this one robbery in 1994 involving another victim where he was bruised and had bite marks and abrasions. And then, of course, the incident from this offense itself involving Stephen Wilcox. So a majority of what the prosecutor relied on were these things that happened with Cowie. That was kind of the basis for the prosecutor's argument. And then the last thing I'd just like to address is the state argues that, you know, maybe in the future there should be a different instruction about parole, but my position is this is Mr. Keohokapu's only chance, and so it has to be right for him in his case. The fact that it might get corrected in the future does not help Mr. Keohokapu at all. If there are no further questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both our attorneys this morning. The court will take this matter under advisement. Thank you very much.